Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout, and Happy New Year. I hope you've been taking refuge from the unseasonable weather and reading.
Exactly, at least it's book weather. It's book weather for sure these holidays.
Yes, I hope by the time this goes to air, though, that the sunshine has come back. But we can't, there's no way of predicting that. Marianne, 2026 is going to be another jam-packed year of some extraordinary books coming out in New Zealand, and I hope we'll be able to cover the bulk of them.
Exactly, and I'm kicking off with one. Ngā mihi o te tauhou, listeners. I've got a book from the end of last year, but it's still on the bookshelves, and I'd highly recommend especially if you have a love of mountains, or it's a deeply affecting book by Kim Rangiao Nui Logan, and it is a book about his life and being his bicultural heritage. The challenges of his childhood and the freedom that he finds in the mountains.
Well, listening to the interview as you did it, I was just captivated by this. I think it will be, as you say, a hugely effective book. As contrast, I'm talking with Jenna Heller, a local Otatahi poet, about her first collection of poems. And before we broke up last year, I talked with another Otatahi person, George Lockyer, who has written many entertaining stories about pubs, about motorcycle tours of New Zealand. He's quite prolific, and his latest book is about fire stations and firefighters.
Well, that's one good thing about this rain is that perhaps our fire service are getting a break from...
Except they're pumping people out, I'm sorry to say, Marianne. Okay. But anyway...
Of course they are. They do it all, don't they?
Yes, they do. And this book will point that out, just how vital they are to the safety of us all. Anyway, enjoy the program. And Marianne and I are... reading wildly and...
Can't wait to bring you more episodes.
Looking forward to this year.
Kim Rangiao Nui Logan has indeed journeyed between worlds, as the book title tells us. From childhood deprivation in a rural Kahungungu community, Hastings, onto the empire-inspired public school strictures of King's College boarding from a very young age, with family respite provided by the generous parents of a school friend. Through constant, confusing and heart-rending alienation from his mother, the loss of brothers, and an almost impassable distance from his remote and yet very influential dad, he found his way into a community of climbers and onto the most challenging slopes and peaks across the planet, stretching himself and losing many friends along the way. Then he built a steadying family of his own and a deepening connection with his whakapapa. It's a lifetime packed into a relatively slim collection of snippets and stories that all weave together to leave a very deep impression. I'm joined by Kim from his home in central Otago, where he tells me it's the only place in Aotearoa that's not raining today. Tēnā koe, ngā mihi o te tauhou, kia koe. Kim, thank you very much for joining us.
Kia ora, Marianne. Thank you.
So, wow, this is a huge life to have survived, Kim. And I suppose that's true for any climber who's still alive at 70, to be honest. But in your case, it does feel beyond that. It feels like you were lucky to have been born at all, really, given how many from the Māori battalion never returned, eh?
And, that's correct.
Yeah, ka mo mahara tonu tato ki a rātou. We shall always remember them. So let's start there. Tell us a little bit about your dad.
Yes, commander, one of the commanders of D Company, 28th Mario Battalion. He's an incredibly intelligent man, fluent in five languages, pianist. He loved his music, but he was a leader amongst his peers. And but he's, as a father, as a parent, he had no idea at all. When he came back from the war, I can't remember that. I remember in the mid-50s. I mean, he wouldn't talk about it. I even to probably the day he died in the year 2000, I don't know if he went to a dawn parade. He'll only talk about the war amongst the other soldiers, and they'll be sort of heads down in the corner talking about things. But he, war was abhorrent to him. I said to my father, I want to join the army, and he said, no, you won't. And I said, yes, I will. Any rate, so I went through the medical and everything, and I thought, right, I'm going in. And I got this letter saying unfit for service. And my father just grinned at me, and he was a major, you know, so he's had a bit of influence. He was going to make sure his children do not go into the army.
Wow.
But it's ironic. The ballot system was still in at the time, and unfortunately, my date of birth came up, and I had to go for another medical. And I told the doctor about the previous interview I had, and he just wrote on my form fit for service. Right. So, but then again, you know, that was the time when there was change of government, and they scrapped it, so I didn't turn up at Wairuru Military Camp. So, which is good, you know.
Right. So not a direction for you, but so important for your dad. I wondered, so you mentioned he never marched. I wondered whether you feel a connection to the history of the battalion and marched for your dad, or whether you'd ever visited Te Rau Aroha at Waitangi. Have you been to the battalion museum?
It's interesting you said that, because I'm going to do that this May. These places I haven't been to, and I've got to go and visit these places. You know, I know probably Nepal and parts of Pakistan and India better than my own country, and I need to get up there and, you know, see what I've missed out. Must go and visit Tane Mahuta, the big curry you have up there. All these little things that I have to do. And so instead of going overseas in May, my wife, Glenys, and I had a discussion. I said, no, let's go and do this. This is important to us.
Wow. Well, I hope, like anything, that you have a beautiful experience up there, and Te Rau Aroha at Waitangi is very moving. It's such an unusual snippet in your dad's story, the win on It's in the Bag, that permitted your parents' seeming never-ending grand tour, you know. Your story would have been quite different without that single stroke of fortune as well, wouldn't it? So it's not entirely clear in the book, but how long was that next era in your life, shuffling between your sometime caregiver, Shirley, back with your parents for a brief time, some stays with your nana? How long was that episode in the book and in your life?
Well, I think they're away. Once my father, it was the sort of money of the bag, Selwyn Toogood was a presenter, I think, then, and they won a trip around the world, and that trip, 2.5 years, and we did have a caregiver called Shirley, but even when they were back in New Zealand, my brother and I hardly ever saw them. We had different caregivers looking after us. I mean, my mother said to me, and I always remember, that she's done her job as a parent. She's given birth to us. Now it's up to us to excel. Now, how ridiculous that. That's not a parent at all, is it? But that's the way she saw things. You know, we didn't sort of fit into their lifestyle, and that is socializing and travel. And I guess there's parents like that today, you know, just push them off into boarding school and they can carry on doing the life that they want to lead. But luckily, later on, I did connect to a family who were fantastic parents and included me into their family. So I learnt from there how to sort of like grow up and be of value to society and be a good parent myself. But you need a tutor, you need a guidance, and I was lucky, very fortunate.
Yeah. That's the Yorks that you're talking about there, is that
correct?
Yeah.
Yorks from up in Auckland. Probably Roddy York, you're listening to this.
Oh, kia ora, Roddy. Looking back, staying with that era while in your parents' first world trip and while you're in and out of caregivers and your nan maybe for some of that time, was Māori culture and community the primary backdrop at that time in your life, to that era of your life, more so than the Pākehā world, or were you moving constantly between and across those worlds even then?
Yes, I suppose my only connection with my Māori side was with my grandmother. She was an incredible human being, she took over from Whenua Cooper as president of the Women's Welfare League. That was the only sort of connection I have in my Māori world. And as for my father, he said he saw it, that the world was changing and there was no... And the Māori or Te Reo is never going to succeed. That was that point of time. And he said to me, I asked him, why did he send me to King's Prep? And he said, look, he said, today's world, he said, in order to survive, you've got to think and speak like a Pākehā. Otherwise, there's going to be no hope for you. And that's the way he thought. And there was a lot of people of that generation, probably academic generation of Māori, that thought, that didn't see like a good future. So from when I went to King's Prep, from a boy, 7 or 8 years old, had no structure, running wild, and only a couple of years since I got rid of my nappies, and all of a sudden into an army regimentated, system, and where I probably got the cane every day. If I did okay, it was every 2 days, and if I did really well, I got the cane or the strap every third day, but it became my family, and eventually it became a family, and I was moulded to who I am today.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it, what, kids can survive, when especially if you think about how carefully today we shelter children from the slightest emotional hurt, and at all, and there's you surviving... that neglect, that cruelty, and then boarding school strictures. You did have moments of real peace and security in your childhood, though, didn't you? So at your nan's and then with the Yorks. Did you think, in fact, the contrast helped you to form your own values? Like, there's that awful and then this is what good feels like? Do you think that helped in some way?
As a child, you just have nothing to compare by. But as you get older, like the Yorks, I thought about is I wish I'd to escape and disappear. But when I met the Yorks, and they included me in everything. When I was at boarding school, I don't think I can remember once when my parents ever visited me. Mm. We just didn't, they've done their job. Now they just want to do what they want to do. And it wasn't for the Yorks who showed me, educated me on how a parent should, conduct their lives and produce children that's going to be of value to society.
Yeah. It's interesting that it must be excruciating for you, Kim, or a habit to have overcome, that 5 years of training to avoid anybody's attention. So here you are now writing your story and sharing your story and being interviewed. It must be almost excruciating. That's a deep habit, avoiding attention for 5 years, first 5 years of your life, in order to survive.
Yeah, I've been writing stories since I was about 14. And then I wrote those stories as a form of therapy because I had no one to talk to about my life. And after every major event in my life, well, not every, but most, I would write a story about it. And it wasn't until, you know, six years ago, and somebody, Anne Ashby Nelson, heard about these stories, and she said, can I put them together? And I had no intention of writing a novel or a book. It was just for my family, but it somehow just grew and grew until I read it and I thought, no, there's something missing here. There's something missing here. What is the message, you know? And I had to really think about what I was doing. And so then I connected with Deborah Coddington from Ugly Hill Press, and she read it and she said, and she only read half of it. She came back to me and she said she wanted to publish it, but one question. And I said, what's that? And she said, why hasn't the big publishers taken this up? And I said, well, none of them want to read it. Simple as that. Mm. And she said, wow, you know.
good honor, because it's definitely, as I say, it's really affecting the, you know, your story is deeply affecting to read it. And so that makes me want to go move on to, I'm very, very sorry for the loss of your brothers, Kim. I've lost two brothers myself. And so, you know, I've got some insight, but what makes your losses seem even more profound, other than the kind of their circumstance, which is sad and awful, but it's also your mother's reaction to you both times. You must have felt so incredibly lonely and betrayed in your grief by that reaction. Can you just fill listeners in a little bit on that? It's in the book, so I hope it's okay to ask about it. And then talk about how long it takes for that kind of loss and betrayal to stop wounding you.
Well, look, that loss and betrayal, the hurt never goes away. I mean, when you get to those sort of questions, no matter how far you go back and readdress things, there's always something, you know, emotional that comes out. I was on my own, and I was sort of more than the spare part when it came to my parents. You know, there was no love or anything like that. But, and the loss of my brothers, it wasn't by accident. It was. By choice and the direction where they went, and they were, I guess, the favored children of my parents, and they always wanted to please my parents, whereas I just closed up and probably put this invisible cloak around me, like, don't touch me, you know, because I was vulnerable, and the only way I can protect myself is to don't allow anybody come in. But, you know, losing my brothers like that, I mean, it should never have happened, especially Wilfred and Richard as well. Mm. You know, it's unforgivable. And I just, when you're going to have a family or children, I want you to take a second thought. And why are you having children? Do you want to leave a legacy, or do you love children? Or, you know, you've got to question yourself, why do you want to have children? Because they're going to be with you, sort of, you know, for a good 20-odd years. And it's a financial burden and it's an emotional burden as well. I mean, you got to be all in or don't do it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're very glad that your mother did do that first bit, because we get to share your story now. So even though she was useless at the next bit, we're very glad she did that first bit. I've got one more question on that, and I hope it's not too testing, but I wonder, it seems like perhaps in that era things were different, but your dad's good looks, his heroism, his military status, his, you know, his kind of amazing skill set, it almost like inoculated his Māoriness in the eyes of Pākehā privileged society, you know, like he was almost like privileged, you know, clever enough and marvellous enough to be part of, considered, had his ticket into privileged society, you know, on your mum's arm. But ultimately, do you think any of your mum's emotional cruelty actually had grounding in racism? Do you think that there was racism at the bottom of any of it?
I mean, they were born. They got married in 1951 or 52 somewhere. But it must have been terribly difficult. I mean, you know, I mean, both came from privileged families in a sense, and but you know, the families never mixed. And I would say, be honestly, the truth is that my Maori side, you know, my grandmother and grandfather punished my father for marrying my mother. Mm. I mean, he was meant to inherit the farm, and they left it to my half-sister, Sandra. And that was a devastating blow to my father. But I can understand why, because they just have a penchant for spending. If they got it, they would have sold it, and at least the farm stayed. And, you know, but my grandfather can see that. On the other side, I didn't have much to do with the Johnstones from Waikato, and they go back, you know, a long, long way. They were cattle breeders and racehorse breeders and things. But, the two families never mix. But, they were isolated. And, of course, having a marriage like that at that point of time is pretty rare, really,
and perhaps overseas feels less conspicuous, you know, so perhaps they were more able just to be themselves away from Aotearoa in some ways, you know, who knows, but it's a fascinating thing to ponder, you know, from a society point of view. So maybe this is a more comfortable start to things for you, Kim. Can you tell us what part climbing has had in your journey to kind of peace and who you are today?
Well, climbing the forest and the sea, it just mellows you down, you know. It brings peace in your heart, and it's just you know, I mean, it's the sight and the smells, and it's sort of, you know, you look into yourself. You got time and to reflect on things. You're not pushed by anybody. You can rely on nature. That seems to have an order nature just seems to have a way of just leveling things out. Whereas in our society, and whether it's the cities or whatever, in humans, there's an element where you can't trust. You just don't know. You know, they say one thing and they could do another thing. I'll forget about politics at the moment, but the world is in a mess. But, you know, nature's the opposite of today's politics, for sure.
For sure. Although, you know, it's still fairly unpredictable. A lot of this book, listeners, a lot of this book is stories of nature, stories of remarkable adventures of Kim's across many of the greatest peaks of the earth, and as well as Aotearoa. There's one story there, Kim, where you wonder how selfish is this act of climbing and the exposing yourself to loss. I wonder whether you could just maybe read that section for us. It's at the top of page 94.
Look, I know. Look, it trying to be a good parent, it isn't, and doing what I did when I was a young man was not being a good parent. Not being responsible. I think I know where you're coming from.
Well, there's no judgment in it. It's just was, and we probably don't even need to read the bit, but Mike's, you know, it's where you're wondering exactly that and coming to that insight.
Well, you know, when you get older.
Yeah, yeah.
And you reflect back on these things and you think, well, I've lost probably, you know, people I've climbed with, not on my rope, but probably 20 or 30 fellow mountaineers, and some of them are terrific people, and it's not fair on. But being a young man, what do you think about is another challenge, another goal? It's like young men going to war or something. But but it was irresponsible as a father to do that. I wish I had chosen some other occupation or job or something. But once it gets under your skin, mountaineering or high peaks, you can't just ignore it. It's infectious, and it's like it's like a cancer in a way that you can't just get rid of it. And I don't know, if you got that inside you, I don't know what to do, but I want you to reflect back, especially if you've got children, is it fair on them if you died? And, how would they feel?
Yeah, it's a very important question for climbers, and the stories of climbing really drive it home. But they also drive home the gifts that climbing's brought into your life, your peace and your sense of self. So it's a great read, listeners. And I understand, Kim, you're off to see Northland this year as a way of reconnecting with Aotearoa. So good luck for that and every other adventure you have ahead. Thanks so much for sharing your story. A Journey Between Worlds is the title of the book. It leaves a deep impression. It's published by Ugly Hill Press, and it's available from bookstores nationwide.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Kintsukuroi. 1. That there are 5 stages of grief does not mean you will experience them in order, or even at all. 2. Common swift stays airborne for up to 10 months every year, only pausing for severe weather. And though it has been 9 years since your mother died, and 29 since you last saw your father alive, you hunker down in the quiet as sadness flies through the nights, the weeks, the years, weaves your days like a golden repair. 3. The gumption. To braid together threads of memory with future plans and present worries into a carefully constructed nest. 4. And what of the swifts that dazzle in aerobatic flight, that pierce the twilight with elfin screams and finally rest in lofts and spires? 5. There is no time to lollygag. The bargaining continues. And acceptance? Well, that requires some other kind of act.
That was Jenna Heller, Ōtātahi poet and short story and flash fiction writer, reading from her latest work, The Dancing Bicycle, a collection of poems. Jenna is a graduate of the Hagley Writers Institute and is very much part of the literary poetic scene here in Ōtātahi. Jenna, it's a pleasure to talk to you about this new collection. And interesting to read at the back that many of these poems got their start as part of a Given Words project. Tell us about that.
Yes. Look, I didn't have any idea that being restricted would actually generate so much. I got wind of Charles Olson's Given Words competition that until recently he has run every year as part of the National Poetry Day celebrations. He's decided to take a bit of a break now, but for the last decade, I have been participating in them. And Joanna Preston also, once upon a time, ran a use these 10 words and 24-hour Given Words. And I liked what I was able to create with that restriction in place. So I put the call out to all my friends and family, and I said, give me 5 words, any 5 words, any language, just tell me what language it is. And I wrote them down and put them in a little jar. And then every 2 weeks, I would pull new 5 words out and I would work on these poems. And many of the poems wound up in this collection. There are some that are truly abysmal, but I was really, I think, impressed with what it unlocked in my head, words that I otherwise would not have thought to even put together. So, yeah, that was the project.
So a gumption and a lollygaggle part of those words?
Yes, actually. Those five words came from a friend of mine in the U.S., and lollygag is certainly a word, an American word, and gumption was another one. And I never would have written kintsukuroi had she not given me those five words. And right now, I can't remember what the other three were, but I do remember lollygag and gumption.
They leap out at you as not being words you'd expect to see in that, but you've made perfect sense of them. That's what I find wonderful. And that poem is about dealing with grief and putting yourself back together. And, of course, the Japanese art of, I'll have to try and say it again, you say it.
Kintsukuroi or yeah. Kintsugi?
Yes, is taking a broken piece and mending it and making it beautiful.
Yeah, a building in the crack into as part of the life of the object and not trying to disguise it and hide it. And I think at the time that poem came about in part because I was trying to make sense of the fact that I hadn't had my father in my life for my entire adult life. And my mother was also gone. And trying to figure out, how do I accept that instead of holding on to all that grief and that concept of kintsukuroi or kintsugi, which I'm sure appeals to many people, was very, very helpful for me.
Mm. And in the beginning of this collection, there are a number of poems about your father, about your life in America, about your mother's death and your last words with her. And those are poems that resonate so much with readers because we've all been through that at this stage of our lives.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. When I was working on the order, I thought that, look, I'm as much a New Zealander as I am an American, and it's really hard to not write about America or only write about New Zealand. And even my word choice, you know, words that don't mean anything to most Americans, like togs, I can't live without. And they are part of my lexicon now. But I thought for the reader, for someone who may be unfamiliar with who I am, it was important to structure the book so that people could get a sense of where I've come from before leading into some of the more New Zealand-oriented poems, because I've lived here since 94.
Places,
roughly.
Yeah, place is so important to you, Jenna, isn't it? I mean, you're really good at evoking what it feels like to be in certain parts of America, and then, you know, where you live out at Brighton, by the estuary, by the beach, that colours your poems.
Yes. Yes, it does. I think that the environments in which we live and play and work and grieve and celebrate, I think there is much a person as the people we interact with. I think they play a huge, huge role in terms of how we see the world and what we value, what we, where the friction might be as well. Yeah.
Again, you don't have to know those places to be drawn into the poem and experience them. It's very much a part, so much part of reading poems like this is to place yourself, allow the poet to place you as well as themselves.
It's one of the things I really enjoy about reading other people's poetry. I don't want to just read poetry or be exposed to writing, which is 100% familiar to me. I want to actually learn about something different, and I want to have different feelings. I want to be able to experience places I've never been to before. So I hope that my pieces do that for readers who've never been to the U.S. And the parts of the U.S. that I'm familiar with and that are in my poems.
Well, they do.
Thank you.
And as you say, it's you know, it's physical places, it's emotional places, it's different ways of looking at things. That's why we read and enjoy and go to particular writers to give us those experiences.
I completely agree. I am sitting here nodding in complete agreement with you, Maureen.
That probably doesn't make a great interview because we agree with each other. Poetry, you know, you must jostle with whether you're going to write a poem or a short story or a piece of flash, or is it fairly straightforward to you what genre you're going to use?
Oh, no, I never really know. I try really hard not to put any constraints on myself when I'm sitting down to write. What I really would like to do is be very open and vulnerable about the emotional component, because I think that I know that that's what resonates with me. When someone's writing really truthfully, honestly, about how something feels, even if it's something I've never been through myself, it allows me a window into that experience. And the more I try to, hold back from that, the writing isn't very good. So when I sit down, like in relation to the given words, I'll have these five words and I'll explore what I think each one of them means. And then I'll look for where they might be connected. And then all of a sudden, there's usually an emotional component that comes up in that. And then I will simply write stream of consciousness. And it won't be until I review the stream of consciousness writing later on that week that I will start to go, oh, I think there's a story here, or, oh, I think this is a poem. And then I start really working with what's the shape of it? How does it look? And like this poem, Kinsukuroi, that I read earlier, that one initially, I really wanted to structure it around the stages of grief. And but I didn't know that at the time. You know, when I did the stream of consciousness in writing, it was just sort of a page of words. Mm. And then I looked and was like, oh, I'm really talking about these different stages. And I know that the stages don't happen in sequence. And so I brought in the concept of the swift and the aerobatics and the swirling. Yes. Yeah.
Works. It certainly works. Jenna, I'd love you to read us another poem.
Okay. I thought I'd read a short one, actually, called On the Trail. Just outside the rainfly, a rouse of autumn leaf music, as the trail stands sentinel from sunrise to sunset to sunrise once again. And again, a pair of hiking boots stand at ease, tongues out, laces undone, longing for the next step and a newborn day, the first day and the next first day, and so on. This small adventure, a foot slog to clarity with life at the heart of it.
Thank you, Jenna, and congratulations on this, your first collection of poems. I'm sure it won't be the last.
Thank you very much, Maureen. I really appreciate it.
The book is called The Dancing Bicycle. It's by Jenna Heller and it's published by Sudden Valley Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media,
broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The Fire Stations of Aotearoa, New Zealand is the latest book from George Lockyer. George lives in Governor's Bay and for at least 9 years was a volunteer firefighter in the area. He's written a number of other books, including iconic Kiwi pubs, Kiwis on Harleys, and Kiwi garages. So it's not surprising that you would follow this up with a look at fire stations around the Motu.
Yeah, it was my publisher actually who was either him or maybe I had the idea. But as soon as one or the other mentioned it, I thought, wow, that's a fantastic idea. Yeah, and it came naturally, really, and it really helped, of course, interviewing these mainly chiefs of these fire stations. It really helped that I knew the lingo, as it were, that put them at their ease. And, you know, they opened up to me and, they told me some fascinating stories, yeah.
Yeah, so a road trip as well as because you did it on your motorbike largely as well.
Yeah, mostly on my motorcycle, yeah. I mean, obviously up in the North Island in the winter, that logistically, Warren, it should just be very hard to accomplish, yeah. A lot of my problems came in, getting the chiefs at the fire stations to respond in the first place, because they get hundreds of emails, I know. And then so you had to get them to read it, get them to respond, get them to agree. And then, of course, we had to line them up logistically in the period when I was in the area, which, in most of my books follow. My MO is very similar in all of my books, you know, to travel around and interview and visit. And it's often quite difficult to get them all lined up.
Yeah, I imagine. And do it, as you say, you wouldn't want to be doing most of it in the winter. You'd be wanting to check these people out in the summer or the spring.
Yeah.
George, as you say, you know, having worked as a volunteer firefighter, it gave you an entree into being able to discuss all these things. You'd know the right sort of questions to ask. But I'm interested, what lured you into volunteering your time and energy?
What lured me in? Well, I've always been very community-oriented, you know, always volunteering for this, that and the other. And I must say it was Andrew Norris. you'd know Andrew Norris.
Yes, I do. Yes.
He still works for FENS. And he was a deputy at the time. And I used to help with the scouts group, actually, where he was in charge. And he basically shoulder tapped me. And, I used to see him around the traps. And in the end, I just agreed to go along. And it just grew from there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, living as we do in a small community, Governor's Bay, I've had several instances where I've needed the fire service. One was a sort of grass fire that got away with the change of wind. We've had a chimney fire. So grateful to see the fire brigade arrived so quickly and so efficiently. So, you know, when you're in town, I guess the people who come to your door, if you need them, you may not know. But in small communities, they're likely to be your next door neighbour or somebody that run into, or, you know, a parent at the school. Yeah. Because I was astonished that 85% of the fire and emergency personnel are volunteers.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's an incredible number, isn't it? 14,000 altogether. That's an amazing number. Yeah.
It seems to me that we rely heavily on not paying people doing such an essential piece of work.
I agree, yeah. I think New Zealand is very big on volunteers in general, yeah. But I must admit, since I left, volunteer firefighters do receive small amounts of money, you know. I mean, if they're out all day, for instance, at the recent Port Hills fires, I think if a volunteer firefighter is out all day, they do get recompensed, which we didn't really get back when I was in the brigade. Mm. We were paid a little bit when we went away on courses, but we were never actually remunerated for call-outs. Yeah. So that's a very good thing, and good on Fens for doing it, yeah.
And, you know, you're required to do a huge amount of training because there are such a variety of events that you get called out to. They're not just fires.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, most call-outs are not fires, really. Yeah. I mean, increasingly, Fens volunteers are asked to attend medicals. So medical training has increased and improved over the years. Yeah. A lot of members are not entirely happy, I think, with attending medicals, but others are. So, you know, if somebody's a bit squeamish, you know, it's made apparent to the chief, and the people who are keen are better trained, you know, can take over. Yeah.
How did you?
But the training is fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's really impressive. And that's what comes through in a book like this, because you're getting the stories from the chiefs on the whole, or the people who are working there, and you're getting a really inside view as to how they organise things and the, you know, how close-knit they are as a rule, as a group.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that a lot of call-outs in small community stations, you would know the person that you're going to. And in some instances that can prove very traumatic, you know, if you're going to a bad motor vehicle accident and you know the person. I mean, and now Fens, I think Fens always has, but I think the trauma counselling is fantastic now, you know.
It should be. It needs to be. Yeah. How did you decide which places you were going to go? Obviously, every so often, you know, I'd recognised a possible name from somebody who had lived in Governor's Bay and moved away. So you had some personal you know, links to some of these stations.
Yeah, I had some personal contacts from people who have moved away. But there are, you know, there are 653 stations in New Zealand, and obviously I couldn't, to cover them all, it'd have to be like a paragraph for each station, and it would take years. So I just, as in my other books, I just try to be as geographically diverse as I can, you know. So I went from Waipu in Northland to Tuatapere in Southland, and I tried to just get a mixture of rural stations. I got a couple of career stations, Gisborne and Spraydon in town, but mainly just a geographic spread, you know. And of course, as I said earlier, it also depended on A, if the chief replied, and B, if they were interested, because I'd you know, lots of them didn't reply. But it turned out all right in the end, I think. I think I got a good cross-section.
Yeah. Which is the smallest? Was it Athol?
Oh, the smallest was in Ngawi, which is at the southern tip of the North Island, next to Cape Palliser.
Oh, right. Yes, yes.
Yeah, and they get an average. And it was like the ridiculous to the sublime, because a couple of days earlier I had interviewed a station officer at Gisborne. And Gisborne is one of the biggest. It's a composite station, so it's a mixture of career and volunteers. Mm. And they get between 700 and 800 call-outs per year.
That's extraordinary.
And then a couple of days later, I was down in Ngawi talking to Buster, who was the chief down there, and they get 7 call-outs per year. And Buster was like your archetypal Kiwi outdoorsman. You know, he's the sort of guy that you'd want in the trenches with you. In fact, I tried, it was hard for me to steer him back to talking about the Fire Brigade because he was so keen on talking about pig hunting and fishing, you know. But that was the smallest station. Castle Point as well, that was quite small. Yeah, so just a huge cross-section. Mm.
And then you, for instance, you've got the, you were talking to the chief up at the airport in Auckland.
Yeah, well, I thought that would make a good chapter to end the book because Tony Scott, or Scotty, he's the instigator of the Auckland Sky Tower Challenge, which is very dear to the heart of firefighters because the money raised goes to leukemia and blood cancer in New Zealand. And incidentally, $5 of the book.
Yes, yes.
Purchase of the book goes to that too. Now, it's dear to the heart because, you know, so many volunteers and career firefighters have walked up the Sky Tower in their full gear and breathing from a BA cylinder. I've done it a couple of times and it's really brutal.
It sounds terrible.
It's brutal, yeah. All you want to do, when you get up to the 51st floor, all you want to do is rip the mask off, you know, because your body is just trying to draw in more and more air and you're getting tighter and tighter. But anyway, I thought that was a good way to end the book because Scotty is a passionate firefighter and it was just a very interesting story. And also, that particular station is not part of FENS. It's a private operation, you know, funded by the, I don't know what authority, it's probably some kind of airport authority.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that was one where he was constantly being sort of pulled away, wasn't he?
Yeah.
There were constant things going on. I mean, not saying that wasn't happening at other stations, but that one in particular, there was.
Yeah, that's right. And that adds to my interview, I think, because it's like, you know, a fly on the wall. And I like to try and create that impression, you know, of anything could happen, you know.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of families involved, aren't there? I mean, thinking of our particular one. You know, once a father or a grandfather and then men and, you know, sons and daughters now.
And daughters, yeah. Yeah, a lot of the stations are, you know, they're generational, Like Andrew Norris at our station, you know, his daughter Anita is part of Governor's Bay Brigade, and I think she's also a career firefighter in town, and his son Alex works on Blue Watch at comms. I don't think he volunteers at Governor's Bay, but he used to. Yeah, that happens quite often, a generational aspect to it, yeah. And also the families, you know, the families are involved anyway. They don't have to be a member of the brigade, like wives and husbands, and they're generally involved in one way or another, and they make sacrifices too, you know.
Well, it's a wonderful overview, and I think it's going to be a very popular book because.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, I'm sure. Fund your next road trip, George.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, I learned a huge amount from reading it, and you have a wonderful way of, you know, evoking what it's like to be in that particular part of the country and how.
Oh, thank you, Mum.
And how the fire stations reflect the people there and the stories that you were told. So
I tried to write a bit about the history, but the history was not always available, you know. Mm. I mean, where it is available, I wrote about it, and there's some fascinating histories, but like I say, it's not always available. Mm.
Well, thank you for the work that you've done. I can see you generally take on things that you're going to enjoy. But it's still work.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, well, I still do a bit of bricklaying and stone masonry around the bay, but so I've got a great combination really in my retirement. Yeah.
Well, thank you for this. The book is called Fire Stations of Aotearoa New Zealand. It's by George Lockyer, and it's published by Catchphrase Media. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.